Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name's Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois, 45 minutes north of Chicago. And these days, the further I can get away from Chicago, the better. The one thing I love about Chicago, the sports is not happening at the moment. So anyway, food's good too. But we are back and we're going to be speaking about Voss with none other than Lane Tipton, who is a fellow here at Reformed Forum, a fellow of biblical and systematic theology. He's also a pastor out at Trinity OPC in Easton, PA. Welcome back, Lane. It's so good to see you. How are you doing?
Camden, I'm doing great. It's wonderful to be back. Very excited about Voss Group.
Yeah, me too. Really looking forward to this. It's been a couple months, really, maybe 6-8 weeks since we've had the last Voss Group, but we're able to connect now and get to it. And I want to get this episode edited and out as fast as possible to make sure we try to stay on track with the rough schedule of one a month. So we might fast track this episode ahead of some others that we recorded earlier. So if I look older in this episode and then younger, you'll realize, you know, it's the magic of podcast land. A couple things to mention while we're at it. Whoops. Got some computer issue there. We've been having some video issues on this particular Zoom call, but I think things are cleaning up. So if people are watching the video wondering why it's a little choppy. It's choppy for us too. But today we're going to be picking up on Voss, page 235 of Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments in the Banner of Truth edition. This, the one I've got here, looks funny and old, but the insides are the same as what you get in the new hardcover edition. I don't know if that's becoming hard to find or something. I don't know what the, you know, people have written in the past, but I think copies are available. And we should mention also that since last time, Banner of Truth has announced that they are publishing their edition of Voss's Grace and Glory once again. So take a look at that. I don't know if that's for sale quite yet, but that's the better version, because the paperback version that has been available is only including older public domain sermons. So there were additional sermons that I believe were uncovered and included by Jim Dennison, if I'm not mistaken. And so therefore the Banner of Truth hardcover, which heretofore has been very difficult to find because it's been out of print and costs a chunk of change to get on the used market, had more sermons in it. But now they're going to be reprinting and publishing their edition, which will have all the sermons in it once again. So it'd be easier to find. We'll try to have links on that. We might be able to revisit some of these things with Danny Olinger, our dear friend. Perhaps we can come up with something to talk about that book in the future, and talk about Voss's preaching, Voss's sermons. Mark Winder, also a friend of ours and a contributor here at Reformed Forum, has also done some significant work on that. So maybe we'll figure something out to do on that in the future. Also, we've of course have the updates to the website. If you head on over to reformedforum.org, you'll find kind of a new design, and I continue to tweak that. The store side of things isn't where I want it to be in terms of functionality, but it works and it's there. We've got some exciting things going on. If you subscribe to our email newsletter, you can easily do so on the website. In the footer, there's a form for that. And you'll be notified as soon as possible about some upcoming things, some releases. We've got some courses in development, some exciting stuff going on with a new online educational platform that we've been working on. And so if you'd like to stay abreast of all that information, the easy way to do it is to subscribe to our email newsletter. Always be updated about what's going on. So there's a lot there. Take a look at it. And if you've got any questions, you can fill out the contact form. And it comes right to my inbox, and I'll try to get back to you as soon as I possibly can. So let's flip on over to Voss. We're looking at biblical theology. And again, I mentioned that we're talking page 234, but Voss starts to speak about some things he's already addressed. So when we come to 234, we enter chapter 6, the content of prophetic revelation. And then Voss starts to speak about the nature and attributes of Jehovah. We've had our talks about the name Jehovah, but that's what Voss uses out of the King James. And this reminds us of what Voss was addressing back on pages 206 through 211. And so that was from Voss Group 55. We're now on Voss Group 62, I think. And so now Voss Group, or Voss Group, 62. Voss Group 55 back in June of last year. So not quite a year ago, but almost a year ago, we discussed the nature of monotheism and whether the prophets, as critical scholars have suggested, the prophets invented monotheism. So Voss addresses that issue. So as we turn now to chapter 6 and look at what Voss is beginning to say and the case he's building on page 234, we're going to revisit also some of the material and some of the case that Voss made on pages 206 through 211. So that just gives a little bit of a roadmap for what we're planning to do today. So, Lane, why don't you tell us a bit about this next section and really what reminded you of the case before, and why is it important that we turn back to page 206 in order to get the full weight of what Voss is saying on 234?
Yeah, Voss is emphatic that something is happening that ought to engage our attention very specifically. We, in the 8th century of prophetism, he says, have come across something that he says is of fundamental importance, the first two sentences on 234, precisely in the sense that in point of newness, they anticipate much of the teaching of the later period. And that later period is going to be the maturation of prophetism as it reaches its high point in the humiliation and exaltation of Christ, the movement, the eschatological movement toward the consummation of what the prophets are speaking of in the person and work and kingdom of the crucified and ascended Christ. But given the fact it's been so long since we've had a Voss group, and given the footnote back on page 211, I'd like our listeners, if they have their copies, to turn back to page 211, because Voss on page 211 gives a footnote after the final sentence of that section that says, see page 234 and following. And here's right. The sentence. The sentence is this: the criticism of its several positions, that is, the criticism of the view of the critics' understanding of prophetism, is so interwoven with our positive presentation of the prophet's teaching, the prophetic teaching, that we cannot help deferring it until then. Now, I know that many of our listeners are going to be thinking, how long ago did we do that? You just said it was Voss Group episode 55. And there are themes that we hinted at, but we did not develop from pages 206 to 211 that really help frame the positive presentation from page 234 all the way through 296. And so let's be reminded of this question, and let's probe some of the features that we didn't develop as fully with a view toward page 234. I think our listeners will appreciate this. And again, let's remember, with Voss Group, the goal is not to cover pages for the sake of covering pages, but to cover the material with understanding and to get a view of what Voss is doing, because typically Voss is doing something at a deeper level than we anticipate. We've learned right. that. So if we go back to page 206 and we look at what Voss says, turn to that. If you have a copy, and I'm going to be talking, we're going to work through 206 through 211 and hit these high points here. But the second sentence in on page 206, here's what he says. The prophets, and now this is 8th century, from Amos and Hosea onwards, are credited with the discovery and establishment of the great truth of ethical monotheism, in which the distinctive and permanent value of Old Testament religion is held to reside. Now, stop and think. Voss is telling us now about the way that the critics, who are modernists, are construing the origin of prophetism. And we're going to hold off this is going to be a little painful for us, but we're going to hold off defining the precise sense in which Voss is using ethical monotheism as we move through some of this material. Ethical monotheism, whatever else we say about it, is a conception of something that is discovered and established by the prophets. So on the critical view, ethical monotheism, technically speaking, did not and could not exist prior to the 8th century. And so it raises the question, what is the newness of ethical monotheism the prophets discovered and promulgated according to the critical conception, that is, according to the modernist or the liberal conception? Well, here's the point that we need to see, first of all. Ethical monotheism, yet to be fully defined, is the distinctive and permanent value of the Old Testament religion itself. So here's what we've got to understand. Ethical monotheism is an interesting development in the history of prophetism, they would affirm. But it's not that it's merely interesting or important. It's rather that ethical monotheism is the climactic and invariant and permanent value of Old Testament religion itself. Now, this ought to alarm us in this sense, that whatever has happened prior to the development of ethical monotheism, exalting Jehovah's character to a new level and giving it a function it did not have prior. Whatever we're going to say about that, Old Testament religion is moving now toward its climactic and permanent value. So what we're thinking about here then is an evolutionary movement toward, if we could put it this way, the true kernel of religious value contained in the Old Testament scriptures. It's not that everything before was unimportant, but it's that those earlier, under-evolved, religiously primitive features of Old Testament religion are finally giving way to what's of permanent and lasting value for religion itself. And remember, when Voss talks about religion, he's talking about the underlying substance, the core, the essence of what the relationship between Jehovah and his covenant people is. So ethical monotheism is the focused, mature, enduring summation of the value of the entirety of the Old Testament. You don't want to discard the rest of the Old Testament, but you want to say, ethical monotheism, that's the epicenter of Old Testament religion. Now, that brings us to this point. If our readers, as we're following along, the burning question is this. What is ethical monotheism? And Voss says this, page 206. He says, ethical monotheism is not a principle of addition, as though the prophets had stood in the first place for monotheism and in the second place for the ethical character of Jehovah. The real meaning is this. It is an ethical conception of Jehovah, of God, that gives rise to this peculiar conception of monotheism. And so to explain it as crisply as possible, Voss is saying that a particular ethical conception of Jehovah gives rise to a form of monotheism of the later prophets in the 8th century. It's a concrete, historical, situated, ethical conception of God that they form, and it's formed in the context of a dilemma. And the dilemma is squarely associated with the situation of Israel in the 8th century, moving in the direction of the dissolution of the theocracy. And so, Camden, as we frame it this way, and this is what I think our listeners need to be attuned to, this is a highly historical, critical argument.
Right.
That there's something in the life of Israel. There's something in the development of God's character in relation to Israel on which everything in the Old Testament turns. And so I don't think we did justice in our episode 55 of just how religiously critical ethical monotheism is for the modernist or critical conception of God himself. So that's the situation. Beginning in the 8th century, ethical monotheism grows out of the relation between Jehovah and the typical theocratic kingdom. And the situation is this, that the earthly typical form of the kingdom, I know we could talk about northern and southern tribes here, but we're talking about Israel, particularly with a view toward Assyria in the 8th century. The exile and the loss of theocratic privilege looms on the horizon for the northern kingdom of Israel. It falls in 722 BC to Assyria. That's the context. Voss, on the bottom of page 207, says that the Assyrian power appears and looms on the horizon. And so let's think like the critics think for a moment and ask this question. What did the prophets face when they recognized that the special privileged relation that God had with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, with Moses and Joshua, with a people called out from among the nations, formed as his people in a special covenantal relation, what happens when that relationship is put under such duress that it appears that the allegedly unbreachable bond of God and his people, of the condescended Lord and the people he loves, the people he swore on oath to bring into the land that flows with milk and honey, and he brought them in and settled them and planted them, as it were, as a vineyard. What happens when that relationship is going to be strained to the point of Israel's national identity as God's people, as God's own son, Exodus 4:22-23, being breached? That's what the critics are trying to deal with. And the question is, on the standpoint or from the standpoint of a modernist or critical reading of the scriptures as a history of religious experience, what did this force the prophets to do in order to explain this breach of relation?
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important question to ask. We ask it all the time. In fact, if you think back to some of our earlier episodes of when we've talked about the nature of the theocracy, Voss has already given a pretty careful answer to this. But let's think about the critics and their view here. Here's the premise. The religious value of God prior to the 8th century, according to the critics, is subordinated to or annexed to the welfare of the nation. Now, Vossians, those of us who have been studying Voss and working through the biblical theology and reading Voss, that's something that's going to create quite a bit of consternation, because what is it saying? Well, God's significance is so tied to the theocracy that if the theocracy is dissolved, if the people of God are dispersed in exile, if they fall under Assyrian hegemony, then the dilemma that is standing right before Israel is, what happens to these patriot prophets?
Right?
What happens? The patriots like Elijah and Elisha, who are the champions for God. What happens when the nation, the theocratic nation, in this special religious relation to God, this bond of union and communion with God, what happens when that's breached? Well, here's what Voss says. He says the patriots for the nation begin to have second thoughts about the nation. And so beginning with Hosea and moving to Amos, Isaiah, particularly intense in Jeremiah, here's the premise that Voss says controls these critical scholars. And it's on page 207, about midway through. I've got it in my notes here. And we need to emphasize this and reflect on it.
And also just to reiterate, Voss is, is you've said it already, but just for the listeners, Voss is describing the modernist view. So he's doing it so well that we don't want people to be confused that this is Voss's view. Voss is setting up, and we'll get to the positive treatment very soon. That's what starts in page 234-ish, where he starts to speak about the positive treatment. Of course, we know that the religious aspect and the ethical aspect and the relation to God for Voss begins the very moment that humankind was created, where Adam was created and placed in the garden. Sooner than he was created, was he also entered? Did he also enter into a covenant of life? God spoke to him, and he had a covenantal, ethical, religious relationship with him that was meant to move forward to an even greater and consummate, glorious relation in the heavenly places. For the critics, though, they don't see it that way at all. And so they view things historically, critically, and looking at Isaiah and Hosea and other early prophets in the 8th century, and recognizing that if God loves them and is good to them, then we've got this great, significant, powerful blessing in the theocracy. If the theocracy goes away, then what happens? Either God doesn't exist, or we have to reconceive what we thought God promised to us, because it looks like he took away everything, or that he failed. And so the critic will say, well, then the whole mindset of the prophets has to change, the whole nature of religion changes, and so ethical monotheism arises as an evolution in response to historical developments. So,
so let not the sympathy with which we're trying to describe the issue make anyone a modernist, right? We're not.
precisely that's the case. I remember one time I took my my brother-in-law came with us to Voss Group, the one in person at Grace Mullen's house. And I think you were doing such a good job of presenting the new perspective on Paul that when we left, he's like, now, do you guys believe that? And we had to explain that no, he wasn't advocating for the new perspective on Paul. He was describing it and then, arguing against it.
Right. And so, Camden, you're 100% right. Let me reiterate here. This is what I think sets Voss off from what I would call so-called conservative evangelical or fundamentalist views of biblical theology, which are simply trying to do the exegesis of the biblical text. He's doing that at a level far beyond anything that we have seen really in anyone else. But at the same time, and this is what makes him so unique, he's so able to get inside the methodological presuppositions of historicists. See, these are, and by when we talk about the modernists or the liberals, they're historicists. They're dealing with the Bible as literature in its ancient Near Eastern context, and they're concerned with only the human and historical features that bring into view rhetorical socio-political strategies for dealing with the concrete political events. So it's a radically secularized understanding of the Bible, and we call it, just so we can put a big frame on this to help our listeners, like you're saying, remember, we're talking about the history of religion approach of the modernists, not the history of special revelation, which sees the communion bond beginning in its redemptive form in Genesis 3 being an ever ascending and deepening and widening and beautiful bond. We're not even dealing with those who believe in the Christian religion. We're dealing with secular scholars who at core, the ones Voss is dealing with, are Pelagian or liberal. So thank you. That we don't want anyone thinking Voss Group has become modernist.
evolution of religion talk.
Evolution of religion. But see, now okay, so now let's get our sympathy caps back on.
Yeah.
And so what on the critical We could call it Pelagian or liberal view. That's what we mean by critical. What happens is that the course of external events, namely loss of theocratic privilege, the rise of Assyrian hegemony, and the certainty of exile, they became the great ethicizer in the prophetic mind. So here's the logic. If Israel begins to replicate the sin, fall, and exile of Adam as a son of God, if the nation begins visibly to lose the divine favor and is moved inexorably toward exile, the logic is this, quote, page 208, the national God has no other reason of existence than to protect his people. Failing in this, his usefulness is at an end. Now, I guess I should say this just for the sake of our listeners. That conception is blasphemous. to say this about the God of Israel would be blasphemy. But here's the point. If you're thinking about it merely in terms of ancient Near Eastern context, leveling the religion of Israel to the religion of the surrounding nations, and the prophets are simply religious geniuses with a heightened moral consciousness, Voss says, on that critical view, God exists to serve the interest of the theocracy, not the other way around. That is the great problem with the critical view. The theocracy exists for the glory of God on the biblical and reformed and supernatural view, but on the critical view, God exists to serve the interest of the political power of the theocracy. And so the dilemma for the prophets is this: keep Jehovah and lose the national theocracy, or keep the national theocracy and lose Jehovah. Now, here's where Voss gets to the core of it. And I do not believe we did justice to this when we were in Voss Group 55. Top of page 208.
Yep.
To escape from this desperate thought, this dilemma, it was evidently necessary to detach in some way the national existence of Israel from the religious existence of Jehovah. This, of course, could be done in only one way. Now, here's where it gets so interesting. If your interest level is low right now as you're listening, I believe your interest level should now go above the average and get very high, because this is something. He says, this, of course, could be done in only one way, or in one way only, by incorporating some other superior element in his character, such as would surmount the idea of national championship and favoritism toward Israel. What was needed was a new and supernational, not supernatural, supernational content to fill up the gap created by the concept of Jehovah through the prospective fall of Israel. Let's call a Vossian timeout and reflect on this, a Voss Group timeout. Note this well. On critical premises, given an evolutionary view of the development of Israel and God himself, the prophet self-consciously sought to incorporate some superior element in God's character that surmounts the national favoritism toward Israel. This implies so many things, but let's just try to pick on about three implications.
Sure. Well, I could even put just, you know, perhaps interject here. What they're saying is the stories that the Israelites made up about God. I mean, a hypercritical person might even be totally naturalist. Not all of them, but a lot of them would say that Israel constructed the idea of Jehovah to serve their purposes. And then as the theocracy formed, they built more and more elaborate stories about how Jehovah was helping them to gain victory over their enemies. And that might have been a story or a myth they created that actually motivated them to work harder and get the victory, so it served its purpose. But eventually, it stopped working, and as things happen in history, empires and nations fall and fail. And so now, when they are taken off into exile, they have this myth they made that doesn't fit with their present reality. So they have to deconstruct that God concept and come up with something else that'll work. Otherwise, they just look like idiots, basically, is what they're saying.
Let's think of it this way. This is the equivalent of, you could call this the pre-Enlightenment Enlightenment. If the rise of critical scholarship under the influence of Kant and German philosophy, although Kant is working in philosophy, but if that created the occasion to reconstruct the doctrine of God, here's the Old Testament analog.
Sure.
Right. So now note this, just some of these points here. If there's a superior element in God's character that now is discovered by the prophets to surmount this national favoritism toward Israel, think of the assumptions and implications. First, showing his love and faithfulness to his chosen covenant people, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, bringing his people into the land that flows with milk and honey through the Exodus, baptizing them into Moses. And even though Moses doesn't enter, the nation does enter into that land through Joshua, and the kingdom prospers. That covenant faithfulness, that love to his people, expressed as an inferior element in the divine character. That's entailed. The very fact that God chose Israel and entered into this special relation with his people is an inferior character trait. There's no way to avoid that implication. The character of God expressed toward his covenant people in the earthly theocracy is what we might coin as a henotheistic defect of the divine character. How dare he be a parochial deity? It's showing favoritism at the national level. This is on the critical view. Secondly, when the prophets on these critical grounds incorporate a superior element in God's character, it's clear that they understand that superior quality, that superior characteristic, to supplement and overcome the inferior qualities or character traits that God had prior to the 8th century. So this is critical to grasp, and this is taken for granted by these kinds of critical scholars. God's character is moving or changing from the arbitrary and inferior character that shows national favoritism toward Israel to the superior character that places the theocracy on an entirely new basis, which we'll get to here in a second. But here's the key. God's character is in development. His character is in process. His character has a newly introduced superior element that is needed in order to explain the failure of the theocracy. And so this is very similar to not simply a view of typology that takes earlier events and tries to reinterpret them in light of present events, naturalistic typology. This is naturalistic theology proper, that if our God in the past showed faithfulness to his covenant promises, and now it seems that the relationship is dissolving, what is needed is a new and improved conception of God himself. And that means that the prophets, in some sense, are the constructors of the divine attributes and the definers of the divine character, and it places God right in the historical matrix of the ongoing evolutionary development of Israel's religious experience. So to put it most basically, and I do not believe this is an overstatement, Camden, we can talk, and I'm sure we can, there'll be many conversations that can be had about this, but there's this symbiotic evolutionary development of God with his people. As the theocracy develops and undergoes various stages of dissolution, so new character traits or new qualities are ascribed to Jehovah in order to explain that. As history undergoes evolutionary development, so likewise the conception of God in his relation to the nation. And so we've said this before, but it's worth saying, this is the Old Testament biblical theological analog to the work you're going to see in Schleiermacher, in Barth, in von Harnack, in all forms of modernism who propose a mutable God given a mechanical and naturalistic conception of history. Mutable God, naturalistic conception of history are going hand in hand here. And that's an alarming development, but it's not a surprise. Third, add to this that the prophets were somewhat ethically gifted above the masses in the sense that they were uniquely attuned to the oppression of the poor, the riotous living, the licentious behavior of the rich, and the deprivation of justice. What did they come to do? Well, they came to be inspiring, religiously gifted geniuses who saw that the older national God was no longer going to be able to serve the purposes of a people in exile. And so they go about adding and refining and reconceiving the very conception of God himself. So let this be clear. And now this is the pastoral point, just in case people were getting drawn into this too much. This means that whatever you want to say about the God of the past, he is not adequate for the present situation. And so fundamental to all forms of modernism, whether it's the critical approaches that you're getting to biblical theology here, or whether it is the expressions of systematic theology from the 17th, 18th century, especially in the 19th century moving forward, God must be reconceived because he is inadequate for the new situation that has arisen, whether it's the Enlightenment in the 17th century, or whether it is the fall of Jerusalem in 722 and under the Assyrian hegemony and Assyrian invasion. Both of these would occasion, in parallel ways, according to critical scholars, the need for a new God or a new conception of God. And so what's been sacrificed by the critics, and I know this might be a longer Voskrip, so we may need to stop soon, but what's been sacrificed up to this point by the critics is at least twofold. Number one, the immutability of God in his covenantal revelation. Whether before the 8th century or after the 8th century, according to the critical view, Jehovah is not immutable, impassible, self-contained, and sovereign. Secondly, what's been compromised is the organic character of God's redemptive relation to his people. And that doesn't come clear until we ask the question, what exactly is ethical monotheism? Now, Camden, we have here just a couple more pages to try to define that. But I think we've said enough, and I hope we've said enough to help our listeners recognize this, that this view of the rise of ethical monotheism in the 8th century on the critical view, whatever we're going to say about the similarities between them, and Voss is going to point out some formal similarities, we have to recognize baseline that this history of religious experience, viewing the prophets as propagandists, as politicians, as those who are reconceiving God in order to account for a situation that they could not foresee and did not like, that is the root of all forms of evil when it comes to talking about religion, because what the critics are saying is that this development is the permanent value of all Old Testament religion.
Right.
And what becomes concerning about that is that the internal feature of ethical monotheism, as Voss calls it, is, and this is beginning on page 209, and I'm trying to get us through this, but page 209, he says that ethical monotheism, he calls, and I think we're going to find this so fascinating, Camden, calls it extreme ethicism or hyper ethicism.
Right. Now, how similar is this? I mean, it's all the same, cut from the same cloth as what we find, as you mentioned or alluded to earlier with Schleiermacher, where we find so much of the reinterpretation of the Gospels as just mere ethics and feelings. We find the same impetus here where they're just applying the similar type of approach to the Old Testament, correct?
Yes, that is correct. If it's Schleiermacher, feeling of absolute dependence. If it's ritual, value judgments. If it's von Harnack, universal fatherhood of God, universal brotherhood of man. It can all be reduced most basically to a kingdom of ethics, of the supernaturalism, the robust supernaturalism of the historic Christian faith, of creedal and confessional Christianity, the supernaturalism of a history of special revelation, this organic, linear, progressive movement of where God offers himself in a bond of fellowship to a people in a federal head, Adam, that will advance into the heavenlies where the throne of God has been set from the beginning, or after the fall, where through the mountain ascending Messiah, people of God will be brought to heavenly Mount Zion to behold his glory. All of that supernaturalistic traversing of the earthly to the heavenly dimension through a crucified and ascended Messiah, pre-enacted and typified in the old, realized in the new, awaiting consummation now as Christ has ascended, all of that is viewed as an absolutely unhelpful mythical surd that we've got to get rid of. Let's get to the essence of religion. What is that? Hey, it's a feeling of absolute dependence if it's Schleiermacher. It's value judgment. It's ethics. Brotherhood of man, fatherhood of God. So ethical
and coupled with that, though, too, is they confuse the progressive unfolding of God's revelation for an evolutionary view in which the Israelites and those who are in control, writing the scriptures and whatnot, are developing things as they go along, rather than receiving God's revelation and seeing God's revelation as part of God's interaction with his people in history. They're viewing the Israelites trying to come to grips with whatever historical life situation they find themselves, and it eventually evolves onto this ethical aspect, which really is kind of devoid of any historical significance at all. They're just dropping the husk off until they get to this kernel here with the 8th century prophets.
They really are. And if you think of Hebrews 3:6, Moses is a servant in a house that the son is building, and that house that the son is building is in his pre-incarnate glory from Genesis 3 up until the time of his historical advent. He is building a house, and Moses is a servant in it, and the prophets are receiving the very words of God, who is building a house, and that house has an organic and progressive development that is ultimately going to be defined around the promises of God that are yes and amen and the promised and now ascended Messiah. But on this view, the prophets are a group of religious geniuses who continue to reactualize these typical connections. If events in the past happened and now current events are occurring, they reinterpret the current events to forge some artificial connection with events in the past. That's the liberal view of typology. And what's happening now, and this is inevitable, is not only is the earthly and horizontal being reinterpreted and updated by these ethical geniuses, so is the doctrine and conception of God himself. And so Voss says that this ethical monotheism is extreme ethicism or hyper-ethicism, and what he means by it is very simple. We can put it, I'm just going to come off looking at Voss really carefully, and I might read a statement or two. But the point by hyper-ethicism is he means that the ethical conception and the ethic that Jehovah reveals does not grow out of the benevolence and grace of God in his redemptive covenantal condescension that informs the ethical consciousness of the prophets. Rather, it grows out of strictly retributive dimensions of the ethical consciousness of the prophet. So the net effect is that this God insists upon obedience that is severed from the warmth and fellowship of a religious relation given in redemptive covenant. So think of it this way. Voss and the scriptures, as Voss is telling us about the scriptures, what is the essence of the relationship that God has to Israel as a nation? It is a condescended relationship of redemptive grace. There is no way that Israel can stand in relation to God in an unqualified Pelagian works relationship. But that's precisely what the liberals and what the Pelagianizing trend underlying the liberalism is presupposing here. God is ethical, and as he is ethical, there is some spiritual relation. But Voss is saying, no, you don't understand the nature of the relationship. The relationship that God has to his people is one of condescended redemptive grace in the promised Messiah, who is present in promises, types, sacrifices, and shadows. And it moves Voss to say that this God of the critics, this God of ethical monotheism, has an unamiable one-sidedness to it. And the ethics exclude the love and grace of God. The ethics exclude a promissory, gracious attitude of Jehovah toward his people, page 209, which is utterly irreconcilable with the ethical premises of the prophets. And what it does is it so focuses on the ethical transcendence of Jehovah as bringing retributive justice to all who do not obey that the critics delete, page 209, large portions of the eschatological promise of deliverance in divine grace. And so what this does is this helps us recognize that when we're talking about the monotheism of the 8th century, the one thing Voss is saying you cannot do is what these critics do. You cannot divide or bifurcate the ethical conception of Jehovah from his condescended redemptive relation to his people in covenant. And that is precisely what the critics are doing. As you begin on page 234, and I don't think we're going to have time to get into this, but he says, when you're getting to page 210 and 211 and getting toward that footnote that turns you toward 234.
Right. He starts to connect it with this positive construction then. So this to this point has been the background. And now as Voss is going to turn his attention to a positive treatment of these matters, not just criticizing the critics, so to speak.
Right.
This is the statement that really, or the axiom that connects it for us.
Yeah, and it's on the top of page 210, and it's going to be moving us toward 234, but he says, notice carefully, it is not the spiritual knowledge of Jehovah that has produced the ethical ideal as to its demands, his demands. The reverse process took place. Because Jehovah was ethical, therefore he must be spiritual. Now, all I want us to see here, I think all Voss wants us to see, is that that conception turns the covenant relation upside down. The ethical grows out of the spiritual relation of the covenant. Why? Because God deals with his people after the fall in terms of redemptive grace. And that redemptive grace expresses itself in a demand that is placed upon the people of God, set squarely within the context of the redemptive indicative in the promised Messiah. So what the critics are offering in my language is the graceless, Christless, ethical construction that paves the way for a school of ethics devoid of redemption. So if you see the essence of Old Testament religion in this hyper-ethical, non-redemptive, let's just call it what it is, Pelagianizing construction. What this does is opens the door for later developments in biblical and systematic theology, whether it's the history of interpreting Paul, whether it's going to be systematic theologians like Schleiermacher or Barth, whether it's going to be historical theologians like von Harnack. The hyper-ethical approach will wind up denying the supernatural deliverance of God in the promised and ascended Messiah, and it will make the kingdom of God ultimately about the universal fatherhood of God and brotherhood of man. And the evolution that's yet to come is that this God who is so concerned, this is the Marcionite trend here, this God who is so concerned to bring judgment, so concerned to mete out punishment for disobedience, this God, when the next evolutionary moment occurs with the coming of Jesus Christ incarnate, God in human form, or as Schleiermacher would say, the veritable form of God is the ideal humanity of Jesus, what do you wind up with? You wind up with the next evolutionary movement where it's not a God of retributive justice. That older Old Testament conception of a capricious and angry deity, it's a God of unqualified love. A God who simply loves man because, at the heart of it, God exists for the sake of man, not man for the sake of God. Now, when we move then to 234, which I think it's going to have to be held in abeyance until we get to our next Voss group, what you've got to appreciate is when Voss begins on page 234 to talk about the prophets as God-centered, here's what he means. He means they themselves find their delight in spirit-wrought communion with God. And the ethical aspect of monotheism is subservient to the glory of God and to delight in fellowship with God. So it's not that they're nail-biting prophets trying to hold on to God while they let the theocracy go. It's that they understand that what is happening in the 8th century is the spiritual intensification of what comprises the essence of the theocracy, which is what? Life in fellowship with God, in union and communion with the promised Messiah for the sake of his glory. And the lesson that the prophets teach is not that the theocracy is sacrificed so that we might hold on to some ethical conception of Jehovah. The whole point of the prophets is that the spiritual concern of the theocracy is the provisional and preliminary expression of the communion with God that is going to be once again intensified and brought to its full fruition in the coming course and kingdom of a humiliated and exalted Messiah. Present already in typical form in pillar of cloud by day and fire by night with the people of God, the substance of the prophetic visions of Isaiah and Hosea. But as we move into a positive construction, it's not this aloof, cold, ethical monotheism of the Pelagianizing critics. It is a God who is heightening the religious fellowship with his people in such a way that these prophets are brought to a point of I suppose it would be useful, instead of trying to speak for him, to read from page 234. I was about to put words in Voss's mouth, where it reaches its highest point, becoming a veritable passion for Jehovah that sets its crown upon itself by reflecting upon and delighting in its own expression. What is that saying? In a word, that these prophets, far from being fearful and forming this new conception of Jehovah to salvage his utility, they are delighting in his more intense, more spiritual approach that adumbrates what? the climactic fullness of that approach that is going to come in the person of a crucified, incarnate, crucified, and ascended, and interceding and returning Messiah. And so it's an entirely different religious conception of prophetism that Voss is after. And I think if we did not do justice to pages 206 and 211, which we just tried to do, I don't think we would appreciate the richness of what we're going to be able to survey from pages 234 all the way, I believe, through 296 in subsequent Voss groups.
Sure. Yeah. We'll pick this back up. And it's interesting to compare and contrast Isaiah and Hosea, as we've discussed, on how they might come at things from their own unique perspective, and that's why they both exist in Scripture, but how they are not contrary to one another. So opposed to an evolutionary view, we have a progressive revelation of God's care and love for his people. And it's not to say that there weren't Israelites who misunderstood. Certainly some of them, perhaps most of them, I don't know, many of them probably tethered their idea of religion to the prospering of the political nation, of the theocracy. And that would have been a mistake. It would have been a misunderstanding of why the theocracy existed in the first place. And so the conception of God need not change pre or post exile if you were paying attention and worshiping the Lord as he revealed himself and as he commanded to be worshiped. But if you thought God was somehow just, you know, a really powerful ally who was meant to give you military victory and wealth and prosperity in a physical realm, in an earthly realm, I should say, and then he stopped doing that for various reasons because you disobeyed, you're going to have problems in your conception of religion because your religion is wrong.
could call that the Sauline eschatology.
Right.
King Saul, right? That's the Sauline eschatology.
It's a king like the nations.
If you buy into that, you're going to be just like the nations. And so, and you pointed this out, and I want us to pick up on this when we come back. But remember, Voss's conception of biblical theology is that we look at the distinctive theologies of the prophets. So he can write a book called Biblical Theology, or he can write a book called The Pauline Eschatology. And what I think you and I are going to get into next time is some of the distinctive features that Isaiah, Hosea, Jeremiah bring to our understanding, not of the evolutionary history of religion, but the organic, progressive, supernatural development of the history of special revelation. And we'll try to keep that up front and clear. But within that history, there is a unique and diverse, but ultimately unified conception of precisely what Isaiah's theology will say in relation to Hosea in a way that's not contradictory, but symphonic within this broader development of the history of special revelation. And it's just a delight to have this work before us, because I still think, Camden, even now in 21st century, I just don't think that this is appreciated as fully and deeply as it should be. Hence, we'll keep trying to work slowly through Voss Group.
Yep, we'll keep at it. Yep. Yeah. We're slowly, getting really close. I've had this piece of paper in my copy on the same page for 7.5 years now, maybe 8 years. No, eight plus years, because this is where you were when I moved back to Illinois. So this is where Voss Group was, and you didn't get too much further, but at least on my page. Page 242, well, actually page 243, Jehovah's Relation to Time and Space. I didn't get to hear that yet in Voss Group. So we're getting close, and we'll pick back up at 234 next time.
Yes, sir.
Continuing on in Voss's Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. And again, get some copies, get one online, and follow along. We'd love to have you join with us and to follow. And if you got any questions, head on over to reformedforum.org. We have a contact page there. If you got any thoughts or issues or whatever, we'd love to try to address them. And we look forward to being back, hopefully, in June with another issue, another episode of Voss Group as part of our greater episode here, our larger podcast heading of Christ the Center. So we do want to thank everybody for listening, and we do hope you join us again next time. on Christ the Center.